Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When. In today's show, I am so beyond excited to welcome Matthew Musandan to join us today. Matt, coming from a background of audit, sales, training, investment banking, and private equity. Today, Matt is a managing partner for PGP, a private equity fund that focuses on supporting founders who are extremely passionate about their business and demonstrate tremendous grit. And today, PGP partnered with them to help them build the business from the ground up. Meanwhile, Matt also is a partner for Vama, a Texas-based residential and commercial development company founded in 2021, focused across residential, commercial, and industrial development. Matt also takes on the role as an investment manager at Huntington Corporate Ventures. With that, I am so beyond excited. Please welcome Matt to the show with me. Well, Matt, I am so excited. Welcome and welcome. With that, Matt, tell us, how does all the magic begin for you?
So the way I grew up was, as I said a little bit earlier, was just a little bit unique in the sense, you know, very early on in my life, I had a lot of love and I had a really good family. My parents, they did a really good job up until, you know, my mom got sick with cancer when I was 11. What that resulted in is, you know, my parents, I was like the apple of their eye because my mom, I found out later in life, my mom and my dad actually had three miscarriages. And so I was the only baby that made it. I was very healthy, very fortunate in that way. So my mom spent an immense amount of time focusing on me and trying to give me a really good life. And then unfortunately, she contracted breast cancer. When that happened, you know, my dad kind of lost it a little bit. He was a good guy. I mean, and it's kind of like both of them combined really taught me a lot of good lessons. My dad, more about proactivity. My mom was very much just about love and going after what you want and everything else. And then when she got sick, I moved in with my grandparents. My parents separated. My dad couldn't really handle it. And then unfortunately, after my mom passed away, I was raised by my grandparents and my aunt. And so
it must be hard.
It was pretty difficult. And then my dad wasn't really around. And my dad was the kind of person where he, and most people would, you know, characterize me as extremely proactive. And I think through, you know, a lot of therapy and working through my emotions as I've gotten older, he was the type of person that he always wanted everything to be like. He wanted to be a movie star. He wanted to be this. He wanted to be that. And
your dad wanted to be a movie star?
Yeah. Why? My name is Matthew Garrett Musandan, MGM, because my dad loved James Bond. So my initials are MGM.
Oh.
He always wanted to. But my dad was one of those people where he was brilliant, like got a 4.0 in college, like was really, really smart. But he could never contextualize or like basically metastasize like what he wanted as his goal in real life. And a lot of the times because of things that were going on and he couldn't really take care of me after my mom passed away when I was 13, it resulted in him, you know, lying to me a lot, telling me things that weren't really truthful. And I kind of grew up in this mindset where, you know, I didn't really want to be that kind of person. I wanted to always go after what I wanted, but I wanted what I was going to say to be, you know, the truth and really be proactive. And but after my mom passed away growing up in high school, I just went through a lot. Like she passed away in eighth grade. From eighth grade until senior year of high school, I was just in a really dark place. I couldn't really expect it from my family. You know, I don't feel like I kind of was just brought to them because they didn't really have a choice to take care of me. And I appreciate them so much. Like my grandma raised me basically, and so did my aunt. And they tried their best, but, you know, as I was growing up, I was really rebellious, getting in trouble, I'd barely graduated high school, and I was able to get into, and I grew up playing tennis, which is one thing that was a really big pillar in my life. Shout out to my coaches, Coco and Yvonne. They were like family to me. You know, when my mom got sick, I was a pretty good tennis player when I was young. I did take a couple of years off when she got cancer. And they'd kind of heard about it. I went to the academy and they let me actually train there for free as long as I taught the kids a couple days a week. And it kept me out of a lot of trouble. I wasn't hanging around with the best kids. I was skipping school, getting in quite a bit of trouble. A lot of it just mainly just really down on my emotions and really feeling lonely. And that kept me out of a lot of trouble. They would like let me train at one of the best academies. I was able to continue to play tennis in college, and that was my original dream. I had no idea that I was going to become some venture capitalist, private equity guy from university, no-name university.
So your dream was to play tennis professionally?
My dream was to play tennis. And I tell everybody, you know, in life, your goals need to be, they need to be of grandeur, but they need to be steps, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't just be George Clooney, or you can't just be Dua Lipa, or you can't just be somebody one day. You have to gradually make those steps. And each of those needs to be small goals that are within the stars, but they're reachable, right? Like nothing. And that's one thing that I really appreciate and I love for my dad, you know, rest in peace as well. My dad passed away a couple years ago. And he taught me that it's like, there's always going to be building blocks to it. And there's always steps and there's moments in life and different transitionary periods. And I think tennis was the beginning of that for me because, you know, I didn't get into college. I had to go to junior college first, ended up going to a junior college at Tyler Junior College, and then played tennis there for a semester, was lucky enough to walk on the men's tennis team at UTSA. They were a Division I men's tennis team. And so I got to live out that dream for a little bit. I was terrible. I played a couple matches. I was going through a lot because I was throughout college, I worked, you know, two or three jobs at a time consistently. I was paying for a lot of my own school. You know, I had to kind of figure things out while I was at school until I started realizing, since I'm half Hispanic, I'm half Colombian and Indian, I started realizing about scholarships and stuff. So I started applying to a bunch of scholarships. So I went from, you know, working through like midway through college, I was like, okay, I'm not going to be a professional tennis player. I need to focus on my education a little bit more.
When did you realize that? Was it a hard realization given that was your dream for so long?
I realized later on in life that the reason why I loved tennis so much wasn't really the love of the game, but because it kept me connected to my mom. My mom taught me tennis. She helped me pick up a racket. Out of all the sports that I ever played, it was one that we used to play down the street together all the time. And it kept a really fond memory because she would drive me to all my tournaments, sit there. Even when she had cancer, she would be sitting on the sidelines and stuff. And it was just such an important part of my life. And I just realized that I just didn't want to let that go because I felt like I was like letting that memory of her go. And so that was why I think it was so hard for me at that time. But then, you know, I believe a lot of good things happen when you make the right decisions for yourself and you follow your heart and you follow your gut. And I was lucky enough to, you know, meet great mentors along the way. And, you know, I started focusing on my career a little bit more, started applying to a bunch of scholarships, and that exposed me to traveling. So I actually went from working three jobs and kind of barely making ends meet to, you know, I made tens of thousands of dollars, was able to pay off student loans and pay for my whole education.
What happened?
I took all the time from tennis and started applying to any kind of scholarship for business that I could. I decided to study accounting and finance, accounting because my friend's stepdad, who is a mentor of me to this day, he was a CEO of an accounting firm. I played doubles with his son. And he said, you know, if you get Jeff Houston, I'm going to give you a shout out. When I left for college, he was like, you know, if you just get an accounting degree and you do pretty well, like you can come work for me. And so I was like, okay, wow, I have like a career in mind. I have somebody who believes in me. You know, I have a direction. I didn't know where I was going for a majority of my life. And I decided to study accounting and later on finance after meeting some friends. And, you know, I started applying to all these scholarships for Hispanics because I'm half Hispanic, and it resulted in me.
You don't say.
Huh.
You're half Hispanic.
Yeah, half Colombian. My dad's Colombian.
That's incredible. Now I see it now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was, it's a really unique mix. My mom and my dad, they met in like this beautiful love story. Like my mom, she was taking a 3-month sabbatical from, she lived in Sydney, Australia. My dad, he was a teacher in Los Angeles. They both took 3 months off for the summer. My dad had the summer off. My mom was in between jobs after, you know, trying to figure herself out. And they met the first day that they were on this 3-month Euro trip together.
Oh.
Yeah. And then they fell in love, and my dad would fly back and forth to Australia, and he ended up moving to Australia for her. And then they got married, and then they moved back to Texas because all the family moved from India to back to Texas. And now everybody, my mom's side's in Houston, and that's how I ended up being born in Houston. And the whole family started there. Yeah. And my mom's side of the family is there. dad's side of the family is in Los Angeles. And and yeah, that's like how I ended up, you know, living in Texas and being a Texan. And it's been such a big part of my life. Like, I love being in Texas. I love being home. Get to meet wonderful people like you and everybody else around. And that's kind of where, you know, while I was in school, I used that scholarship money to actually, I was a really savvy traveler. So I would, and I think this really exposed me to a multitude of different people.
Yeah.
I traveled to 38 countries with my own, with my family helped me with my first Euro trip. After that, I paid for everything on my own, and I was able to, I found flights for like $300 to Australia, $400 to Japan. And I would like find the most budgeted way to, you know, travel the world, figure out, like see things. Like, my gut and my heart was just telling me, like, hey, you need to explore.
That's beautiful.
Like, you need to see these things. And
is it 38 countries?
38,
yeah. How long?
4.5 years.
That's insane. Are you a full-time traveler? I mean, that's just...
Yeah, if you ask my friends, my nickname's Muzzy, and that's where Muzzy's Bagels comes from, like one of my investments. But if you ask my friends who know me from college, they'll tell you that for a couple years there, 3 or 4 years, because I would take sabbaticals. I was in college for 5.5 years. I would do internships, made, you know, kind of chess-like decisions with my college career. Uh-huh. I was way older than everybody else because I actually had to take a couple years off from school. Because I was homeschooled because my mom was really sick and I wanted to spend more time with her and I didn't go to school. And I was always a little bit older. And then while I was in college, I was there for a long time.
Why?
Trying to figure myself out, figuring out what I wanted to do. I pushed back my graduation to try to get onto Wall Street because of a situation. But, you know, while I was traveling, I would come back and then I met some really good mentors. Like, I got an internship at PwC. I met this guy who ended up becoming one of my biggest mentors ever. His name is Ricardo Rosales. He's like a brilliant guy. It was like, his story is crazy. Like, he's like one of the most intelligent people I've ever met in my life. And he, you know, came over here, you know, with his family from Mexico, is basically like a coding genius. And then went to NYU, had to transfer back because he studied for music. And then he came to UTSA and then decided to want to go into coding and finance. And he became one of the best students at UTSA, became an electronic trader at Goldman Sachs. And then he was coming back from his internship, got a full-time offer, which is what quant trading is, right? Like, the best traders on Wall Street are these guys. And so...
And was it what you wanted to be at the time?
No. I wanted to be an investment banker.
Why at the time?
Because no one at UTSA had done it from undergrad. Everybody had either had to go get a master's program or anything else, but I wanted to be the first person from undergrad. And it's
but
around...
Why?
It just felt like, I don't know, my gut, right? Like, I just felt, I looked at the job, I had heard about it. No one from UTSA had done it. Ricardo had done this other thing. And I was like, you know what? I go to UTSA. No one really does these kinds of things. I want to be one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of like a reachable stars, right? It's
yeah.
Like, okay, this guy did this. I want to go a little bit further.
Yeah.
Like, I want to go a little bit further. And there were alumni who had gotten good jobs before, but they were all in sales and trading because we had a club at UTSA that kind of focused on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had come back from his internship and it was his last year in college. And then I basically joined this club very last minute, my fourth year out of my fifth year. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to have an internship the following summer. And your pendulum summer, and ended up trying to apply to and I started studying with him and doing everything else. And I tried to apply the first time and I got rejected from all the investment banks. I didn't even get an interview. I got an interview for operations in Dallas and the guy literally on the phone told me, you know, why are you studying finance? You should just focus on accounting. Like, you don't really understand.
Oh no.
And then
how was that experience impacting you, Matt? I know you laugh about it today.
I mean, I think about these things. And they were all right at that position in time. But I think that life teaches you lessons like when I went to college the first time or, you know, my family was very supportive, but I come from an Indian household, right? So they want you to be an engineer, a doctor, or something else. Like, they're not really like trying for me to be pushing the boundaries of a box, especially education-wise, because they don't think like a lot of families like – are sometimes come under the guise of like they want to protect you. So they don't want you to think of these crazy, outlandish, you know, crazy things. And
They want you to play it safe.
Yeah,
that's
play it
how
safe,
they love
play it
you.
Safe, play it safe. Play it
that's
safe.
How they see love for themselves and they give
exactly.
you what they think the best.
Exactly. And, you know, I applied, got rejected. And then that summer, you know, I was like going into the summer, I'd picked up a last minute internship at a local biotechnology company. I'd got an internship with PwC in the spring. So I was doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was enrolled in the master's program at UTSA for a little while. I was going to do the master's in accountancy program, but I also double majored in finance to give myself enough time. And I decided to take the spring off to, you know, try to get another crack at the fall, an interview. And then over the summer, my grandpa, who raised me, passed away. He had been suffering after my mom passed away. He had a stroke and he had just been, my mom was the oldest of all the kids, six kids. And so it really affected my grandpa a lot. She was like the apple of his eye. He called her his pearl, like Maria, my pearl. And he had like all of these like really beautiful, you know, things. And it affected my family a lot. She was like more of the like matriarch to all the kids, helping raise them. And she was very close to my uncle. And, it resulted in, you know, after my grandfather passed away, you know, I really took it upon myself to realize, you know, life is too short. I need to push myself a little bit more and go after what I really want. And that summer, I decided to cold call hundreds and hundreds of people. Like it happened at the very beginning of my internship. I started studying an investment banking book and finance book nonstop every day. And then I saved up enough money to get a suit tailored and stuff. And I borrowed a suit from a buddy, and just to have a few, and then ended up being able to sleep on my friend's couch. And then what I did was for 2 weeks, I went to every investment bank and I stood outside those investment banks
in New York or
in New York. So I said,
but while you were spending time in, but your summertime internship in.
So I, at the end of my internship. So
oh,
I saved up all this money. I worked as a waiter at Topgolf part-time. So I would do the internship, work as a waiter at Topgolf part-time, study on the weekends. And then I gave up drinking, gave up going out. And it's funny, Jimmy will tell you part, because our stories are so intertwined to where it is today, and I'll get back to that. But I basically was like, you know what? I'm going to give up everything and see if I can actually push myself to get to where I need to go. And
wow.
I ended up, you know, after standing outside of all those investment banks, I got lucky.
You literally stand outside without telling them.
With a beggar, yeah, like a beggar. No, I would email them.
Uh-huh.
So I set up these two.
What do you say? Like, hey, Matt, I'll be outside.
Yeah. I mean, no, I would set up a call, get on the phone with them, tell them my story, kind of like an elevator pitch.
Uh-huh.
And I would tell them where I am as the story is built today.
Uh-huh.
And I had to say, and so that's why I'm used to telling my story a lot, because I've had to say that throughout my entire career.
But how do you logistically, do you tell them once you pitch that, I say, well, so nice to meet you. Hey, by the way, I'm outside.
I'm
going to
be in New York for 2 weeks at the end of the summer.
Uh-huh.
I'd love to set up some time with you, you know. This is like my last ditch. I'm honest with them. I was like, this is my last ditch effort at, you know, trying to get an internship. I really, really want this. I'd love to grab coffee. And if you like spending time with me in person, I'd love an opportunity at your firm. And ended up getting three internship offers.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But all sales and trading, because I had no investment banking experience.
Okay. That is where you school good at.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then,
were you not
trading,
happy with that? Were you happy with it? As a
I pivoted. Thing? So I made myself believe I wanted to be a sales and trader. I had no idea what was involved. I ended up getting an internship at Goldman, which is where Ricardo worked, which my mentor worked, which was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. He's just a couple years ahead of you at the time, right?
Yeah, a couple years. And so
he also in sales and operations.
Yeah, sales and trading as
trading,
well.
Trading, yes.
Yeah. And he actually, during my interview in the fall for Goldman, you stay at this hotel called the Conrad. Goldman owns it on the right, connected to the office at 200 West. And it's right next to the One World Trade Center. You know, I'm showing up and a kid from my background who didn't really grow up with like that much is like looking around. I'm interviewing at this massive, beautiful building with like all of these
things
in New York. Yeah. I remember.
Were you excited? Were you a little bit like, oh, I don't know?
I mean, we had done a New York trip before and the school sponsored it. And I would like looked around. I was like, you know what? I'm going to work here. Like I was at the top of the One World Trade Center. I was like, I have to do whatever it takes. And and then I show up, but then I'm actually interviewing, right? I interviewed for BlackRock. I got an offer at Citigroup and then one of the MDs at Citigroup, she is still a mentor of mine today. During my interview, I kind of told her my elevator pitch. She started crying in the interview. It was a very beautiful moment. Like, she's a wonderful person. Her name is Mara. And I have to thank her immensely as well. She's helped me with so many decisions. I remember I'd interviewed at Goldman, didn't hear back, got an interview at Citigroup, got an offer at BlackRock for their alternative investments, which is like a fund of funds thing. Mm-hmm. And then what it resulted in is I called Goldman. She told me after she gave me the offer, she's like, you know what? It's my job to tell you to come work at Citi, but you need to go work at Goldman if you can get a chance. You should call Goldman, tell them that you have an offer with us, and see what happens. So I called Goldman, told them that I had two offers, told them that I wanted to come work there. They gave me one last interview the day that Donald Trump was elected. So the markets were crazy. And basically, they asked me some gold questions or some macro market questions. A week later, I got the offer. And it was around the 5-year anniversary of when my mom passed away. So it was like one of the most proud moments of my life. And on the day that she passed away, I signed an internship offer. And then a week later, Goldman gave me one of their scholarships. So I was one of the interns that got paid double for the summer. I got a scholarship from Goldman. And there was a handful of people from UTSA that had gotten it before. And it was one of the most beautiful times of my life. And
Were you so proud of yourself, Matt?
Yeah. I mean, my family was really proud. The school wrote an article about me. It was kind of like a very surreal moment. Before that, I'd had some panic attacks. I'd kind of had some situations in which, like, am I crazy? Like, why am I putting everything on the line for this? Like, why am I pushing myself? And, you know, sometimes you just have to have blind belief and a good support system around you to, like, want to go and achieve, you know, things within your life that you perceive as, you know, being great or achieving like small goals of greatness that you can notch on like your life's journey. And
not a small goal, but yes,
it was really, really good. And, you know, it resulted in me, and then it resulted in so many, you know, different avenues, but it's all attributed to being right place, right time. I would just say,
but you're working really hard,
30% hard, 70% luck. I would say that's my view. I think I've met a lot of really amazing people along the way that have been just, and I can name them in every step of the way. And then even my mentor, like I lived with him for a bit, and I remember I didn't talk to him for a while, and then I gave him a call and I got my internship at Goldman, and he was just like, Jeff was just like, he couldn't believe it. He's like, how is this? Because he emailed me like 2 years before. He's like, hey, when are you going to come intern for me? When are you going to come work for me? And then 2 years later, I'm like, hey, you know, that belief of you telling me to go out and take what I want and rather than staying home, because my family wanted me to go to school, university in Houston. They didn't want me to leave the city. They wanted me to live at home and do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I really, really felt in my heart and my gut that I wanted to leave. That was like a little bit of a controversy, but it resulted in, you know, that was one moment of many moments where I was like, even when I got rejected from the investment banks, even when, you know, I wanted to play college tennis and I didn't get into any schools, even when I didn't get into college. There's a lot of moments in life where you're like, everything around you is telling you can't do something or you shouldn't do something.
Yeah.
And for some reason in your gut or in your heart, you're like, it sounds crazy, but I think I'm going to just jump. And then I just got so used to just jumping and jumping and jumping.
Was that the hardest jump you ever done though, Matt?
Which one?
What would you describe the journey of getting to New York? Was that the hardest jump?
That was the craziest jump because I had told everybody about this. I had lost a girlfriend in the process too. So my ex-girlfriend, my grandpa passes away. My ex-girlfriend tells me I'm too focused on this pipe dream. My family thinks that I'm like just going after things that aren't realistic.
So what made you to really believe in that vision, even though everyone else tell you that's not possible, Matt?
I mean, I went from a kid who barely didn't graduate high school, basically, and I was getting kicked out of school and getting in a lot of trouble to, you know, I just like every small goal that I wanted to do that a lot of people had told me I couldn't do, it comes from just figuring it out on your own when you're a kid. And it's like small achievements lead to big achievements. Mm. And that's what people don't really... They want it right now, and especially with social media these days, everybody wants it right now. And
the patient.
And I never thought I would be an investment banker when I went to college. And then I went to go do it. And here's another jump. Like, I went to an internship at Goldman. Wonderful
firm. Do you love
it? Wonderful firm. Mm-hmm. I was horrible at the job. I was working with kids who went to MIT, Princeton, Harvard. I had immense imposter syndrome. Like, I was like, did I just get really lucky? And then I had a lot of panic attacks during that internship. And like, I just, everyone was already had relationships. Like these guys, like Goldman is a very systematic place. It's a brilliant place, probably some of those brilliant people I've ever worked with, but it's very systematic. Like you need to know people before you go there. You need to have a plan. Like you need to, and these kids have been training since freshman year of college at Wharton, right? And I'm over here like UTSA. I can't call anybody because nobody knows what an investment banker does at UTSA. Like I have these courses, but it's like, and or in sales and trading, Ricardo can't help me because Ricardo's a genius. And so it's like, I can't code. And so I go into it and throughout my internship, I do horrible.
And you know that?
Yes, I do horrible. But, you know, halfway through, I kind of realized that this isn't for me. And so I do what I did best. And I went through the Goldman directory and I started reaching out to every investment banker in the Goldman directory to grab coffee with me. I met with 33 of them in person. I ended up getting an interview even after, you know, Goldman HR told me I wouldn't because my reviews weren't that good. And I got an interview for industrials at Goldman, didn't end up getting the job. But I went out and then after my internship, you know, I had a situation in which, you know, there were a couple of instances where I just felt like I wouldn't grow where I wanted to grow at Goldman. They had given me an opportunity to interview in a group that was like more operations focused. And I was like, I'm not an ops kind of guy. I want to be front office. I want to create revenue. I want to be in a position where, you know, I can make a difference and I can do things. Like, I really think that I have a different mindset. And I had to believe with that within myself. And I left rather than interviewing for an operations job. I left Goldman without an internship, which is career suicide. And
That's so brave.
And I networked my way into three interviews, one for sponsors at Deutsche Bank in San Francisco, didn't get the job, interviewed at where my friend was an investment banker at in oil and gas in Houston at Scotiabank. They told me that I was a little too aggressive because I was like trying to get into Wall Street and being whatever. And then I had one friend who I knew from UT that had gotten a job at Guggenheim, and Jeffrey Tubey, I really appreciate everything you've done for me as well. Like you just introducing me to those people has like changed my life. I'm just going to give him a shout out. He got me an interview. I networked, cold called a bunch of people at Guggenheim. And, you know, during my interview, the guy, I'll never forget this, one of the managing directors, he like looks at me and he's like, so why should we hire you? You know, like it seems like you've had some issues and all of this stuff. I was like, look, one thing that's different about me is like, throughout my life, I've had to do whatever it takes and I'll do whatever it takes. And if I can't be an investment banker here, I'll just be an investment banker somewhere else. And he said like, oh, that kid was ballsy. We need to hire that guy. And then that's the moment that changed my life forever. And it was on my birthday. I got the job on my birthday. I flew out to New York for Guggenheim in my last semester of college, ended up getting a generalist position there. And that was
what you want.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what I wanted. It's a top 10 investment bank in the world.
Yeah.
I was going to go do that. And same thing. I mean, I started out poorly there too. Like, it's like every position I've ever started, except for when I started at Stone Point, I did horrible. Like, I was like, I didn't know anything, but I was also the type of person that I was okay with being known as a person that didn't know anything. I think it made me dangerous, actually, because I would like ask the questions that I needed, not the questions that I think people wanted me to ask. Right. And that has resulted in so much because I just people that were my mentors never felt threatened by me. So they just told me everything. And it's kind of, and then I basically learned all of these like shortcuts. And I ended up, same thing in banking. Like, then I had 6 months in between my job, traveled to Southeast Asia, traveled the world, came back, started investment banking. Summer of 2018, and I was in a class at imposter syndrome sent in again, bunch of Ivy League kids, me, boutique, investment bank. And then my first year, I worked every day for like 8 months, literally every day.
How many hours?
80 to 100 a week for every day for 8 months.
What, 9 to 12?
Get in at 8:30, 9, leave at like 1 to 2 a.m. every day.
Every day.
And then I was horrible because I didn't know Excel. No one had taught me how to be an investment banker before.
You did not know Excel.
I didn't know Excel at all when I showed up. I didn't know Excel at all.
How is that possible? You have an internship at Goldman.
In sales and trading, you don't need Excel. Like,
okay, but you also major in finance and accounting.
Yeah, they just want you to understand markets. The whole internship is like, we call it running around with your head chopped off. Like basically, you're just sitting behind traders. They're asking you random math questions. And I wasn't good at math. I was like, oh my God. What's funny is like, I'm really good at it now. What you need to be an investment banker. But like at that time, you know, I was just hustling and just pushing myself. So and
80 hours a week though.
Yeah, 80 hours a week. Yeah.
And then what happened, man?
And then my first year, you know, it was my fault. I had, you know, been a little disrespectful to one of the star VPs at the firm. I just didn't tell him that I was going on a vacation and he got really upset at me.
Oh.
I, you know, went through a situation in which, you know, investment banking is like a GPA. So
okay, explain that.
So basically, whatever reviews you get will stick with you at the firm you're working at for the rest of your career.
Yeah, okay.
And so if you have a bad review or a lower than par review, it will affect you for the rest of your career at that bank.
And
so it affected me for the rest of my career at that bank. But one thing that I did was is like, you know, I was bottom of my, even though I worked just as hard as everybody else, I wasn't up to par technically. I was coming up the curve a little bit more slowly and then I caught up after my first year. But basically, you know, because of that situation coupled with me not being the best at the very beginning, there was a stigma towards me for a while. And I don't blame anybody for it. I think it was like on me. I should have learned the culture and I should have been, I made a couple of really big mistakes and I take ownership for that. And but I think it was like an amazing time. You know, for me, I grew up in a place where I learned politics. I learned like a lot about, you know, people are going to kick you in the nuts and you need to get up and like, they will treat you like shit, whether you like it or not. Right. And for me, that was the first time where I got the same bonus as somebody who would leave every day and work 40 hours a week and refuse to work hard. But he was an Ivy League kid and people would make fun of him. He would sleep in meetings. He showed no respect to anybody. And they paid me the same as that guy after I had worked as hard as I could to get to where I was. But then you realize nobody gives a shit, right? Like nobody cares. And every time that happens, you know, I just put it in fifth gear. I quit drinking, quit going out, studied every weekend with one of my best friends, George. Shout out to him, George Cloris, like literally probably one of the most influential people in my career. He helped me, taught me everything I know to study for private equity. He was one of the best analysts at the firm. So I became really close to him, worked underneath him. I was in financial services. And, you know, the following 2 years, I would argue, became one of the best analysts at the firm. They underpaid me. I'm going to admit that because they paid me not what I should have been paid in certain instances for the quality of work that I was producing. But it's okay. It's like a GPA. You reward people who have consistently been performers relative to others. But, you know, overall, Guggenheim changed my life. And I thank every single person that I've ever worked under, John Jedlicka, Matt Zunick, you know, Gen Takahashi, Raghav Khanna, working alongside Mahi, Luca, Walker.
Incredible.
You know, all of those people that I worked with, Teddy Freeman, you know, RJ Jensen, Ashu Rathore has been one of my biggest mentors since post-banking and really looking out for me and just understanding like the politics of life and being at that level, right? It's like Zach Lavin, of course, Lavinator, can't leave him out. I love shouting out these people because when they first met me to who I am today, I wouldn't be anywhere that I am without these people.
So what happened next from there?
You know, after that, midway through my analyst years, I gained a little bit of respect because I started doing better. And then I got a job at one of the best private equity funds in the world.
Mm.
You get recruited 2 years in advance and I got a job at, I was recruiting, got rejected by 10 firms. I was getting all of these crazy interviews at KKR. I had a 7-hour interview at KKR and, not that many people, same with Goog. It's like kind of like UTSA. It's a new bank that was the ashes of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. And a lot of the old guys are Lehman guys. My old head of my group, John Jedlicka, was a Lehman guy. A lot of people work there and, relatively new, but we had started getting some notches on the belt. Like one of the people in my cohort got a job at Blackstone Growth, which was huge. Some people got jobs at Carlyle. Like we were getting some glimpses and those people have ended on doing really successful, went to Harvard Business School, Stanford Business School, and like ended up resulting in me getting a job. And I interviewed and I got a job at Stone Point, which in financial services is the best private equity fund in the world for that, for my sector. And I remember that after I got that, rather than, you know, not caring, because that's what a lot of people do, they stop caring. I worked even harder because I was like, I'm not going to start Stone Point, where ironically, I'm going to go work for one of the ex-CEOs of Goldman Sachs now. I went from hating, like, not doing that well at his firm to go working under one of the ex-CEOs, right? Which is hilarious. And, you know, worked until the very end. And then my dad passes away. And, you know, near the end of my banking career, my dad passes away February 2021. And that took me for a loop. You know, I thought I wanted to be who I wanted to be at that point in time. And then my whole world was kind of crushed. Fortunately for the pandemic, I worked remote from home in Houston. So I've developed a really good relationship with my dad, really got to build a strong relationship together. And I realized, like, he wasn't meant to be a father, you know, at some points. And, like, the stuff that he had gone through and me realizing that, I was, like, fortunate enough. My dad didn't really have that much money. He actually kind of died penniless. And I was able, one of the biggest things I'm proud of is I was able to buy him a ridiculous funeral. They were like, the hospital was like trying to, I was in Colombia at the time, traveling for a month. He passed away during my trip, which my dad was so proud that I was going to Colombia. Like, I never traveled there, and he always wanted me to go. And I remember he sent me one of the last text messages, was like, he was so proud of me for, like, all the things that I've been doing. And he would always tell me, he's like, you know, like, you always, like, are so good at achieving your dreams. Like, hopefully one day I can be like that. And, like, just wanted to – he was just a good dad. Like, he tried his best. He didn't really know.
We all just do our best.
Yeah, yeah. And he – and, you know, I came back and I was like, is this what I really want to do? And, you know, Jimmy, my partner, is my best friend. And for the last 10 years, he's been trying to start this development company, which ended up being our – private equity fund that we run today.
Tell us more than that.
Yeah, I met Jimmy 10 years ago, fall.
But this moment, you were in private equity at the moment,
I was in private
right?
equity. I was going into private equity. I took 4 months in between my job.
Mm-hmm.
And then what resulted in that was, you know, I went, traveled the world a little bit, really escaped after my dad passed away, and then ended up doing a little bit of ayahuasca in Peru. And my buddy took me there. It really opened my eyes to that life is too short and go after what you want. And Jimmy had been talking about doing this private equity strategy, this real estate private equity strategy for a while. We didn't know what it was going to turn into. We started it before I started at Stone Point. And, you know, it kind of snowballed into being a really good vehicle. Like, we're doing really great returns. Like,
tell about what you are up to.
Well, so we do... So whenever you look at private equity, right, or you look at developers, usually they're two separate entities, right? Like, you have, like, a big developer like D.R. Horton or somebody, and then if you co-invest with, like, an investment firm, like, usually there's, like, a firm like Blackstone Carlyle or somebody in real estate that partners with them. But the thing is, like, developers through invoices can hide a lot. And so what we did is my partner Jimmy, he'll tell you his story, but he's, like, a genius. He basically was like, I want to start my own development company, but I want to do from beginning to end. Like, I want to find barren land. I want to find unzoned land. I want to do the underground utilities, and I want to do the vertical construction, and I don't want to pay extra for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really understand the strategy at the beginning until we started running the math and I started doing the modeling, and we raised our first miniature fund, I would say, or like our first investment.
How much was that by the time?
$450K for our first investment.
Nice.
And we ended up, you know, the strategy had ended up returning 200% in 19 months. Yeah,
that's
wild.
That's huge.
It's wild, right?
Yeah.
And then our other investment ended up returning both triple-digit IRRs. We were working with another developer just doing the land development. And
so that's all y'all purely focused on at the time, development.
And so that's what he was focused on. So he was a developer since he was 16 years old. His dad owned a GC company, a stepfather, and that resulted in him going to school for construction science and management. We met at UTSA.
Oh, wow.
And then we joined the same fraternity. We intertwined there. And he'd been talking about this for like 8 years. And because we started 2 years ago, actually. And what it resulted in is, you know, we started the vehicle and it just kind of snowballed and did really well. And he quit his job. But before that, he was like, oh, you know, I'm going to be a developer. Started a development company on the side while working at one of the biggest developers in the world.
Yeah.
He built one of the buildings at NASA.
Oh, wow.
Was one of those people. And then he ended up saying, you know what, if I want to start my own development company, I got to become an attorney. So he went to law school, quit, did development on the side while in law school for home builders, ended up going to U of H Law. Same story as him, went to Mississippi first semester, realized he needed to go to a better law school, transferred to U of H, got into a better law school. And, you know, from there, he ended up, you know, wanting to start his own development company with me.
That was when you all started.
He kept asking me. And after I went to Peru and came back, I was like, you know what? Life's too short.
Yeah.
I've lost a lot of people that are very close to me. Let's just do it. Like, I don't see why I can't just do it on the side. It's just real estate. I'm going to do financial services, private equity. And then it resulted in me, you know, we started the fund. He ended up quitting law a year later, or a little under a year later, and has been focusing on this ever since. And then
how does the business pivot from development focus to where it is today? Tell us more about that.
So that was another thing that happened was, you know, while I was at Stone Point, it was a big tug of war. And then I had another friend pass away that I knew. So he was younger. He was a guy that I didn't really know that well. Jimmy knew him better, but kind of realized, you know, while I was working at Stone Point, I was like, I'm working 100 hours a week. I'm working with the most brilliant people I've ever worked with in the job that everybody wants. Like, I'm working at a $45 billion private equity fund. I'm a deal guy. So I'm like one of the guys that they put on a bunch of deals. And I, like, thanks to Ian Uruguayan, you know, for mentoring me throughout my time at Stone Point, Jared Levine, you know, a lot of the people that I worked with alongside me, Freddie, Ali, you know, Ryan Josephson, you know, Lizzie, people in my class that were just such a great support system throughout my time there while I was going through that. Because I was going just through a lot of emotional ups and downs. I started going to therapy, started dating my girlfriend Anya now, as you know. And, you know, I started reevaluating what I wanted out of life. And
which is what?
Just freedom and the ability to help people. I started noticing, you know, at Stone Point, we do a lot of cleaning up. And a lot of my friends who work in private equity, even my buddy George, we talk about this very often about how private equity, you come in and you make things more efficient. And people misunderstand what we mean by efficient. Like, people are like, oh, they come in and they fire everybody. Well, it's not that. It's just, it's poor operational, like, efficiency, right? It's like, but what if we taught people to not make those mistakes, right?
Up front.
And so while I was working there, you know, I just noticed there was a lot of cleaning up I had to do, evaluating data, cutting data. And then I started noticing all my buddies in venture capital and growth equity don't really know how to do that. Because you're an investment banker, you're taught the tools, but implementing those tools are done at private equity deals. And so
So there's a gap between venture capital versus private equity. And when founders grow in that stage, there's a gap in the middle.
Exactly. And I learned that very, very quickly when I quit Stone Point and I started working in Huntington and I'm still there today. I help manage $250 million for Huntington. We do fintech focused financial, you know, financial technology type of investing, but for corporations. So it's a lot slower. So I had a lot more time to focus on stuff that I wanted to work on, but also get fulfilled. I love my team there. Like, my team there is wonderful. Like, they know about my real estate fund. But as far as the venture capital fund is concerned, that kind of vehicle that I invest in started, you know, in November of this past year, because I worked in venture capital for 7 months and I just started noticing, like, how are these guys raising tens of millions of dollars and they don't know their unit economics well? Like, why is there no financial sections? And also, it's because of tech. Like, my thesis is that people have gotten so used to, oh, we don't need a model, we don't need this, we don't need that. I even had a validation recently about that, where the entire industry is this. Venture capital is a giant marketing tool. Growth equity is a giant revenue growth tool that's more marketing. And private equity, if you're lucky enough to have a founder that survives, is the people that come and be the cleanup crew and then they give it to the public or doing anything else. So my thesis was, well, what if I just started investing in businesses where I bring the level of due diligence that a Blackstone or Stone Point or somebody else would do, and we bring it down to venture capital and we find really good founders and really good people and we help them to where they don't lose control of their companies. They don't do any of this stuff. And, like, I give them the tools that even if I invest, like, I'll be an investor that has no expiration date. Like, I come in and I will be a part of the company and a part of the board and give you insights you know, throughout your company's life, and you don't have to worry about me worrying about a fund that you have to liquidate, or worrying about like I have to deploy people's money because I'm charging management fees. Like my fund is completely management free, fee free.
Mm.
I have a different carried interest schedule.
Which is?
I charge 5% for every 10% IRR more.
Nice.
So it's 2 and 20. So like 20% of the carried interest above, you know, 20% IRR. And then I do 5% from 20 to 30, 30 to 40, like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why—
Long game. You play a long game, not a short-term
exactly.
change.
And the reason why I do that is because I think that financial investing and private investing today is aligned to be capital allocators, mm-hmm. not be actual good investors. Like since we, like Tunnington, we invest in venture capital funds and they're all raising four funds over 2 year periods that have 10 year lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you run the numbers and you look at private equity, the way that they calculate IRR and stuff is actually, you know, I don't think it's correct, because when you commit to a private equity fund, that money needs to be set aside because you don't know when they're going to capital call you. So theoretically, the cash can't be used, but private equity funds love to look at IRR, and venture capital funds love to only look at IRR when the capital is called. Well, I committed $4 million to you 3 years ago, and you've called it over 3 years, but my money has been stuck in my bank account for you to take for the last 3 years. Like, why? If you actually look at the IRRs based on that, their IRRs are worse than the S&P 500 for a majority of them. And they won't tell you that.
Are you being serious?
I'm 100% serious.
Wait. We talk about all venture capital fund? About
90%? A majority of the investors. If you look at the way that they calculate IRR, they won't like me saying this. It's the way that they look at, they're like, oh, we only look at it when you deploy the capital, aka when they capital call you. That's not the way that I let my investors invest. I let my investors invest from, you get paid from the moment you give me the money.
Mm.
And I don't
got it. There's a gap
from the moment
give
you
it
commit
to you versus
from
call.
The moment you commit it, mm-hmm. and that's why I do things on a deal by deal basis. Like,
got it.
I from the moment you give me the money, you're getting return on that money. Like mm-hmm. that, I have a ticking time bomb. Mm-hmm. Whether I use the money in 6 months, whether I use the money in 12 months,
doesn't matter.
We count. That's the way that I look at my IRRs.
Wow. So what is your number with that? I mean, if you open to share or not?
No. So we just started our first few investments.
Congratulations.
From the venture capital fund, yeah. We're starting the bagel shop, and then we are—
And this is different in the development firm.
The development company is completely run differently.
Got it.
Those deals have been same thing. And so that's how we got inspired to do deal by deal, because the development company is deal by deal.
It has to, yeah. And they're both run by both of you?
Yeah, run by both separately.
Nice.
And so Jimmy, being an attorney, has done M&A law and has a bunch of experience.
So you focus on that.
He helps me with the law part, and he focuses on the development company. I do the finance. I talk to investors on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they invest in our opportunities and that all that stuff. You know, we invest in early stage good people. Like,
yeah, tell us a bit more about who do you invest in. A fund who are listening and say, wow, this is so cool. How can I join you, Matt?
So you,
tell me, who are you looking for? How's that?
So right now it's just a small community of people that I know.
Yeah,
that I've worked with or have gotten to know me and have given me an opportunity. And our first few investors are super happy. They made they've made like 40% a year for the last year. Yeah. And then we keep the rest. The total return has been like outrageous, like triple digit IRRs.
Nice.
But
you already have returned the first year in the—
One of our investments is returned, and one of them is coming to a close very soon, and it's going to range in that range. Yeah, like 40%.
So fast, even you're doing a—
Yeah, because we didn't like— I don't like the way that funds are run. I don't like the 10-year fund. I do deal by deal because I allow for my investors to come in and out of the investment.
Wow. So he and she can just come in and let you know I'm leaving, Matt? That's fine?
We learned this from the real estate fund. So I do—
So
all the due diligence before I even come to an investor. So I'll build like a SIM quality or like an investment banker quality due diligence deck. And then I'll give it to him and you can still say no.
Yeah.
He's like, whatever. I don't want to do it. And like Jimmy and I will be investing our personal wealth and you won't be investing in an institution. You'll be investing alongside us.
Got it.
But you'll be investing alongside us with the stipulation of like the payment and the structure.
Check size, minimum?
50 usually.
Yep, not bad.
Yeah, not bad.
Nice. And what about founders? What kind of founder you partner with?
I look for founders that are just passionate, and I do all the boring stuff.
Like, what stage of founder are you looking at? What sector are you focusing
on? So there's two. So I also do consulting. And one, here's an example, two deals. The founder that I, the bagel shop was 9 months of diligence. We were going to work with somebody. It ended up falling through. The founder ended up, you know, wanting to ask us for something that we just couldn't agree to. And then for a few minutes after, like a week or something after, like the people who had been working with us liked us so much that he introduces somebody. Now we're working with this other guy. The deal ended up becoming way better. And this guy's like a Michelin star quality chef now, making our bagels. And he's like unreal. And Daniel Cachot, like literally one of the most talented culinary like people in Austin. And I'm so excited to work with him. I'm excited to work and work on all these different concepts with him. And he's a brilliant,
I cannot wait to try the bagel
myself. And we're going to be featured in the Austin Business Journal soon for the bagels. And we just had, and he's, he is just like such a wonderful founder, and I'm excited to work with him. He's like worked and cooked all over the world. And then another group is I do consulting, but also take on equity. So I'm consulting for this boot company. It's been around for, you know, 80 years, the production company. And they decided to start making their own brand because they were producing for these boot businesses like Thursday and Tecovas that are, you know, creating these brands that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're like, why can't we do that? And so the I'm helping the family. They turned their business from, think about this, December 2020, made their first sale, only made $2,000. Now, last year, they made $2 million in sales. They're growing like crazy.
They're helping the growth strategy? What do you
have? No. This is where they're at right now.
Okay.
And they're making, they made $350K in profit. And they're like the best quality bootmakers in the world, right? Like they've been doing it for 80 years. They and they're friends with the people who make the leather. They have like all the value chain.
They're expert,
But they're located in Mexico. They have a US business, which makes up a little under half of the business. But this company, like they have so much potential. Like they do everything in-house and they just like they don't have access to US capital markets or else if these guys were growing like this, they would have access to all of this stuff. And so I'm coming in and I'm helping them, you know, build a better business. I'm becoming part of the equity stack for them. And I'm also, and so they become part of my portfolio. It's like I'm a minority owner relative to them, but I'm coming in and I'm teaching them that as they grow and if they need to raise venture capital money, they won't be taken advantage of. Like there's a recent situation that I've, that, that like I had where I'm not going to name a name, but there's a top tier venture capital fund with a portfolio company that I had a conversation with. And they told me that nobody knows how to financially model there, like to the level that I know how to financially model. And it's like my thesis, right? It's like they don't care. That's why their portfolio is like hundreds of companies. Like they don't care. They want people to do it for them. They want to teach them how to hire a few people and pump a bunch of marketing dollars and throw a bunch of parties. But they don't like they care about their founders in the same system. I care about them completely differently, right? Because I was, I feel like I've been different than a lot of people that work on Wall Street. I think only
you are so obviously different, Matt.
Like the last 20 years, I feel like there's been a lot of opportunities for people like my background where normally there was a lot of barriers to entry to go work on Wall Street. And I don't think the system today, as far as private investment platforms have the, you know, are really like going out there and being like, you know what, I'm going to put it on myself to be right. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to help people. Like I'm going to give them tools that they would charge millions of dollars for. And I'm going to give these to these people that are starting restaurants, that are opening up their businesses or just getting started. And rather than the power being, which is why I call it Prometheus Growth Partners, because Prometheus is the god or the titan that gave humanity fire whenever, you know, the world had flooded. And then his punishment was he had to be, his intestines had to be eaten out by a bird every day. And his eyes for the rest of eternity. So my view is this, there's a knowledge that is not being given to the public that is held by people in high finance. My goal is I will take that knowledge and I will give it to normal people. I will give it to people that have never been afforded the opportunity to understand what financial statements really do and how to run their business and do this stuff. And I'm going to help them grow and I'm going to be there.
I love it.
And I'm not going to be somebody that's like, oh, it's time to sell. It's time to sell. It's getting close. Time to sell.
Yeah.
I'm going to be like, no, let's make some strategic decisions here.
Matt, with that, I'm so curious. With such a beautiful journey to unfold, what do you eventually want?
I think I'm in the spot where I'm supposed to be right now. Like, Yeah. I'm excited to, you know, grow. I'm excited to have a family. I'm mm-hmm. excited that I am taking control of my life and I'm helping such beautiful businesses with such yeah. beautiful people that are there mm-hmm. and that I'm able to give this knowledge back to people that I know. And,
so beautiful.
Know, and like, that's where I want to be. I think I'm exactly where I want to be. I'm just starting. I'm taking my time. I'm not going to raise funds. I'm going to do it my way. And mm-hmm. I want to do things in a way where like, I feel like based on my mission and my character and where I came from, that I'm looking at people like me that, you know, didn't really have a lot and like didn't really have those opportunities afforded to them, like, or even knew what this was.
Yeah.
And I want to teach them that this is possible and to save and to protect them and to like help them. And like, that's my dream. And I feel like I'm just getting started and I'm so excited for the rest of my career. And I'm so excited to get these opportunities and for whoever introduces me to any founder, like I feel like when they get to work with me, they'll see that. And I'm just excited to see beyond bagels and boots, like what's next, like bagels, boots. Maybe I just invest in companies that start with a B. We'll see. But
hey, start with that.
Yeah.
Wow, Matt, what a beautiful story. And thank you so much for being so authentic and transparent. And I know it's been a long journey. And I felt like for you, I can just think about hustle. You hustle every step along the way. And you are someone that having a fire in your eyes and you don't give up. Does not matter whatever the universe tell you, whatever sign tell you, the people tell you, like, you know what? That's a goal. I'm going to go forward. And today, seeing you have come every step, almost like hiking a mountain. You hike one step at a time. And now you arrive at this beautiful new height of yours. And now you're taking those insight, the knowledge and know-how and the passion. Now you turn around to empower and give others a hand that need it. And through the funding you do, through consulting you do, you're really helping those amazing dreamers who might also have a fire in their eyes and tell them that, yes, we do it together. I thought it was such a beautiful journey. So thank you so much for being here today. I am truly honored.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to, if I ever come on the show again, I'm excited to join. And
we will have to have a episode 2.0 because there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll give you an update on what everything that's going on and everything else. And so, no, I really appreciate being here. Like, thank you for the time. I know it was pretty long-winded and I was talking a lot.
No, it's perfect.
Okay, good.
It's perfect. And that just back us for another episode.
Yeah.
So with that, thank you so much, Matt. And thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in today. We hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. Cannot wait to see you all next week. Bye, guys.
Bye.